Distributing the Future, broadcast February 17, 2006. Attention streams, taking pictures, Java in Brazil, and presenting differently.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week, Rael Dornfest and Tim O'Reilly continue their preview of next month's Emerging Technology Conference. Bruno Souza talks to us about Java in Brazil. Conference photographer James Duncan Davidson discusses his art and why the Lucky Stiff shows us that conference presentations can be much more creative than they tend to be. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Host your next meeting online with GoToMeeting. Everyone logs on to your meeting during your conference call so they see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's like meeting in person, but less expensive and time-consuming. With GoToMeeting, you can demo products, present, or train just like you're in the same room. GoToMeeting has a low flat monthly rate, so meet as often as you want for as long as you need. Try it free today at gotomeeting.com/DTF. That's gotomeeting.com/DTF. With all the information streaming by you every minute, are those who can't keep their attention focused on any one thing for too long better suited for this world we're building? Tim O'Reilly and Rael Dornfest continue their discussion with members of the press in advance of next month's Emerging Technology Conference. How is this change in the amount and the nature of available information changing us? Tim begins by considering what would happen if technology could take better advantage of your history. As you move from page to page, feed to feed, post to post, you're leaving a trail of information that can be used in many ways. It could even identify you.
We create a history. You know, and there's always been history in the browser, but it's not been used for very much. If we really kind of keep our history in a more profound way, we could actually use it. We could use it to say, give me more like this. We could use it to say, hey, I already entered my credit card data over here. Let me also enter it over there. You know, so it's sort of like, how do you build a way of taking that attention stream that has happened as we interact with our computer and turning it into an asset? And in this particular case, trying to say, I want to turn it into an asset that's owned by the user as opposed to owned by the site.
There is a market there for your attention. And what you're doing most of the time is just not even realizing that. And by focusing in and taking a look at some of your history and some of the categories you've been in and effectively how much money you've made somebody by paying attention to their web pages, you can start at least a dialogue and start as a dialogue, a market. And you can start to build a market around advertisers who want to reach customers and customers who are prepared to put up with a certain amount of advertising so long as it's targeted correctly. The old come and take a look at these condos and we'll give you a toaster. But there's a certain amount of that where that paid off for the advertiser as well as for the customer.
But I also think that there's an aspect to this where it's not necessarily about consciousness. I'm seeing a bubbling up of people saying, we're going to start capturing everything that happens to us because it's who we are. And then you'll be able to, for example, thinking about, presenting a credential that's a unique hash of everything you've ever visited, for example, is really pretty damn hard to duplicate rather than, I've got this, this password. That's a real identity. And so I think there's some interesting things bubbling up. There's also ways of just how do you store it from everything from, you've got the research projects like, Gordon Bell's My Life Bits, which everybody kind of goes, I'd never want to do that. But there are other ways that as we accumulate more digital assets, in some sense, we're building a digital unconscious and not just a digital conscious. Moving back to the sort of thread of walking through some talks, Linda Stone's talk, she calls it attention, the real aphrodisiac. But really, it's about how the current bombardment of the immersive net is changing the way we actually use attention. She has this phrase she uses called continuous partial attention. And it's a really powerful concept. She's really observing that people, behavior that we used to think was dysfunctional, ADD, is the new normal. If you think back, I think of myself as a literate person. And my brother, when I was a kid, I was like this total klutz. I just was totally immersed in books. Whereas, as a kid, I would strike out a kickball. I don't know anybody else who struck out a kickball, right? You know, my older brother used to refer to me as the failed hunter-gatherer, right? You know, I would have been a total failure in a sort of a pre-literate society. The point is that, you know, we're now in this interesting transition phase where people who are really good at multitasking, you know, have actually been given drugs to make them more like the people are good at, you know, being part of the industrial economy and, you know, sitting there and on a 9-to-5 job. And in fact, you know, a lot of these ADD kids are actually, they were born for the world we're building. And I'm not sure it's whether it's good or bad. I mean, we lose a lot as we change. You know, I can't do things that, my ancestors could have done without thinking about it, but I can do things that they couldn't do. And I think our kids are going to be able to do things that we can't do. And I think that's another really interesting theme that, you know, as we interact with our machines, we are changing. I actually remember a conversation I had with Eric Schmidt before he went to Google when he was still at Novell, and it was within a few weeks of when he went to Google. He was obviously thinking a lot about it. And he was saying, you know, I was talking to my daughter. He said, doesn't it bother you that sometimes you search on Napster and you get, a different version of the song than the last time you searched? And she said, no. Does it bother you that sometimes it's there and sometimes it isn't? No. And you think about that as it applies to Google, and I've thought about it a lot. The whole idea of rigor, what we find, that there's one right answer, has really changed. Google, you know, gives you some kind of collective hunch that's approximately right, and it's good enough. And it's not a system for giving you necessarily the best answer, but it is a good system for giving you the good enough answer. This also goes to something that George Soros talked about in his book, The Open Society. You know, he said everybody's focused on this binary logic, things right or wrong, true or false. And he said, you know, many of the most interesting phenomena in the world are what he calls reflexive knowledge. He says it's things that are true or false depending on whether people believe them. You know, he said politics is like that, markets are like that. And now what we're finding is that, you know, the web is like that. You know, what matters is what people believe in.
If you can build tools that will enable you to, as we talk about, harness the collective intelligence of not just the wisdom of crowds. We talk a lot about the wisdom of crowds and the internet as a large, but really harnessing the power of tens, you know, 10 to 20 people, your family, your work group, your peers, people interested in the same things you are, people have the same activities that you do. I think that you will be able to start seeing some of the promise of the wisdom rising in your own data, not just the data out on the net. When I first log into the RSS reader at Yahoo, don't give me sports. I've never liked sports. I've been a customer for 5 years. I still don't like sports. And I think the next dimension is bringing in people, again, around activities and interests that are similar to yours. Family groups, friend groups, they know what you find interesting. And there should be no reason why they can't help influence some of the things you see, both in terms of what you're reading as well as what you might be purchasing on Amazon. You know, purchasing circles was an original take on that. But, surely through some of these mashups, we can get to the point where I can bring in friends who know more about cameras than I do to be able to decide which camera to buy on Amazon and not just go by, well, this one has a good rating amongst, you know, N thousands of people, some of whom may know, you know, a lot of whom probably know nothing about cameras.
You know, we start a lot with the hackers. They do a lot of innovation, where a lot of this innovation is all about, you know, oh God, I got to make money. I got to, you know, figure out, how my company is going to get acquired by Yahoo or whatever it is. But there's also this other thread, which is very deep in the hacker spirit, which is I want to make sure that other people can use this work. And, we're starting to see the kind of activity in open source where people are getting that this sort of next generation of web applications is an interesting playground, and that it's not just about building infrastructure software for deep down in the stack. They're kind of wanting to get up and play at the top level, and so you know we have a lot of interesting open source activity that's starting to run through this area.
Tim O'Reilly and Rael Dornfest, part two of their preview for next month's Emerging Technology Conference in San Diego. You can find links in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. If you've been to an O'Reilly conference in the last year or so, you may have noticed the official photographer quietly moving among the crowd or popping up quietly, perching his camera on a monopod during a keynote to grab just the right shot. James Duncan Davidson's talents and interests have always been split between art and technology. He was trained as an architect. That's architect as in design buildings, not as in draw bubble diagrams for software. He's been a pretty serious hobbyist photographer over the years, and now he's moved into the realm of professional. Here's part one of a conversation we had with Duncan in Amsterdam at the tail end of EuroOSCON.
I always had a camera of some sort around, and I kind of got back into it in a big way when I was working at Sun, because when I was working on the servlet spec and then later Tomcat and all the open source stuff, they were flying me all over the place. I got to go to Asia and Europe and destinations all over, and I wanted to take pictures. I mean, it was kind of a thing that was boiled in from childhood. You know, you go somewhere cool, you try to take some good pictures of it. And so it was at that point that I picked up a real 35mm SLR again. There for a period of time, I was using little smaller cameras and not being too pro about my equipment, except for an old Nikon SLR that was my dad's. Yeah, somewhere about 1998 or 1997 when I was traveling for Sun, I started picking up the big gear. I was doing it with bonuses, you know. I ship something and they give a bonus. And one of the things I wanted to do with my bonus money at that point was always have something to remember the bonuses by. When we shipped a Java web server, which was the first project I worked on at Sun, you know, I could have put it into a general fund and just used the money. I could have put it into savings, and I did put some of it into savings. But one of the things I did was I bought myself a Canon EOS 3 film body and started buying lenses. And then, you know, next bonus comes along, I go buy a really nice lens, and then next bonus comes along, I buy another really nice lens. In fact, some of the lenses I shoot with now still date from then.
You're a geek, and you've had that geeky side, but you've also had the artistic side through the architecture and all that.
Right.
What were you taking pictures of when you first picked the camera up?
Buildings and places. I've always had a love for buildings. I spent 8 years in architecture school before all this geekery. You know, I see pretty buildings. I love taking pictures of it. Seeing human experiences and places that people have human experiences in has always attracted me. It's interesting that I put it in those terms because I really didn't start taking pictures of people until much later. In fact, fairly recently. For a long time, taking pictures of people scared me. It was something that you had to try to figure out, how do I capture this person? How do I make the moment happen with the person? Whereas when you're taking a picture of a building's a static thing. It's not moving. I mean, you play with other things that are moving, like the light will move, the clouds will move, and that kind of thing. But it's much more of a long thought process. You can sit there, you can look at the building, decide how you're going to get it. Whereas when you have people, it's all very fluid and dynamic and a very hard thing to do.
And a building will wait while you change lenses or pick the right
exactly angle. Exactly. You can move around and the building doesn't care. The building's just sitting there, having a good day or a bad day. It's sitting there.
So you find yourself now being paid to take pictures of people.
Yeah. Who'd have thought?
You still seem to be really enjoying it when you're working. It doesn't seem to be, and you can say that about a lot of photographers, you know, that when they're working, it doesn't feel like work at that point.
No. There are some things that are a drag about doing photography. I mean, everybody knows what they like to see in images, and they think they know what would make a good photograph. So you always have the person that says, oh, well, why don't you do a photograph of XYZ and compose it like this? And you just have to figure out how to gently say, I don't think it's going to work. Or you have the people that say, well, you know, while you're here, can you get this for our records? You know, can you get the layout of all the booths at the conference so that we can keep those in for our records? And, you know, that's a drag too, because, you know, I'm here to get pictures of the people in the conference to really communicate what the conference is to people that aren't here. Taking static pictures of the booths is not going to serve that purpose. That's documentation. But then you take an image that people see a day later, and they come up to you and they say, you know, that's a really cool image. Thanks so much for taking that. You know, that just, it makes everything else go away. Like Damian Conway came up to me this morning, and he was like, you know, normally nobody can get a good picture of me, but you got a good picture of me. That's so cool. And I'm like, aw. I was like a little puppy dog there for a minute, which was nice.
Some of the feedback's been interesting because you post your pictures on Flickr for the conferences, and I saw someone see their image up there and say, oh, I should bring a camera next time. And, mm-hmm. and you've got a dialogue going with them. So it's not the way we think of photographers, where they take the pictures, they go away to a dark room, and they're delivered to some anonymous. These go up so fast, and there's still a relationship with the people you've been shooting.
Yeah, when O'Reilly approached me about doing this early this year for the Emerging Tech Conference, we knew that we wanted to try to do something that was kind of in that emerging tech realm. You know, emerging tech has been where you get a bunch of people that have played with social software, and you know, they started talking about the Web 2.0 meme there, where you get community interaction going on. And Flickr itself was launched at eTech a couple of years ago. I thought, you know, there's this Flickr thing, and it'd be really cool to be able to take the images and try to get them up fairly quickly so you can get a feedback loop. I love feedback loops. Feedback loops, when you can exploit them, really work out nicely. And that's what we did at Emerging Tech. I took the pictures. They were going up on the Flickr. People were seeing them. And as soon as people started seeing them, there was a relationship that started. And then I could get more pictures of interesting people because they knew that I was going to be doing them in such a way that wasn't going to make them look like an ass, that I was going to try to get them in the moment. And they appreciated that, and that created this nice cycle. And it worked out so well that we kept doing it.
So you leave here, you're heading home, you're stopping in some places along the way. You leave your camera behind it. Are you burnt out from taking pictures for a week, or is this still part of you?
It's still a part of me. I mean, I'm in Amsterdam. So I'm probably going to set the camera down at the end of the day and not do any pictures tonight. I'm going to go out and have a couple of beers and, you know, enjoy the city. And I'll sleep in late tomorrow, and maybe I won't do anything with the camera tomorrow. And then I just want to put my iPod in my pocket, put some good tunes on, walk the city, have my camera, and go see what finds me.
James Duncan Davidson. Next week, we'll talk a bit more about the equipment he uses and about his switch from film to digital. Also, while we were in Amsterdam, we spoke with Bruno Souza about open source development in Brazil. In this third and final part of the conversation, Bruno explains why Java is an important part of this equation.
One of the reasons why Java has been adopted so heavily inside Brazil by companies and by governments is that Java represents a choice of getting off a specific dependence from one specific company, for not only getting away from the Microsoft lock-in, but also to get away from mainframe lock-in, from IBM lock-in, for example, you know, from the big companies that were there, right? So Java was an alternative that would free them so then they could choose any vendor for the OS. So they could choose Microsoft if they wanted, they could choose IBM if they wanted, but they could also choose something else. You know, 1996, 1997 was when the first time any developer in Brazil ever considered developing anything for Linux or for even Unix. Right, because everything was developed only for Microsoft Windows or DOS. At that time, a lot of DOS things, right? So the choice for Java is a different freedom. It's a freedom of platform. All of the Java standards that are out there, they can be implemented as open source. This distinction between if the Java standard is run or not by an outside organization from Sun, I don't think that matters that much. But the most important thing is that the rules of the GCP are very clear. And anyone can actually participate in GCP. We have Brazilians that are a part of the Java 5 specification. We do have people working on Java 6 specification. We have people working with JSPs and Java Surfaces. And there's a lot of Brazilians working around participating on the Java standards. The GCP is a very open standard organization. Of course, it's not perfect. But I think one important thing is that the standard that the GCP generates are licensed royalty-free. So you can implement open-source implementation of the Java standards. And that's extremely important because that's the combination we want. We want standards that can be implemented as open-source and that have multi-platforms implementations. And if you take a look at other standard organizations, that you can say, oh, but you know, ISO, for example, is an independent organization. Brazil does not ignore the fact that there are other battles to be fought. So, for example, we have been discussing through the United Nations the internet governance, for example. So there's something that not many people realize, but the United States kind of dominates internet governance. And there's not much we can do because that's something that the United States, we not allow others to participate very well. And that's a battle we're fighting right now. And we're fighting all the way up to the Brazilian government, doing, you know, sending representatives to all of the discussions, you know, even the president talking about these with other presidents, so we can have more participation. So our idea is to be part of these discussions worldwide in all kinds of standards, and none of them are perfect. So I think we have to improve all of them, and we don't improve anything by being off of it, by just saying we don't care, right? That's one of my main complaints about the discussion between, you know, Java and open source. Is because as long as you keep the Java developers away from the open source discussion, because you say Java is not open source, that's a totally meaningless statement, because it means absolutely nothing to say Java is or isn't open source, right? It's like saying HTTP is or isn't open source. It doesn't mean anything either. If you push people away from this discussion, so the discussion never happens, and what we need, there's an open source implementation of the Java standards, also never going to happen, right? So right now, we have this interesting situation that we have these very, very good developers trying really hard for many years to implement an open source implementation of the Java virtual machine. And although it's possible, there's almost no company behind the effort. There's very little investment, absolutely, you know, very little interest from developers, because usually developers said that, you know, you're not part of the open source community, so go away because you're a Java developer. So there's very little interest from the developers. So in the end, what we have is that we don't have an open source implementation of Java.
Bruno Souza on development in Brazil. What is it that makes a great presentation at a conference? The fluid presentation styles of people like Larry Lessig and Dick Hart are being noticed lately. The Lessig style is a proof by example that PowerPoint presentations can be engaging and that the medium need not result in the reading of bullet points one after another from an endless deck of overcrowded slides. But you can push this envelope much further. At OSCON last summer, Why the Lucky Stiff did a multimedia presentation on the programming language Ruby. Part of what made it so engaging was Why's relaxed style.
We're going to show you some technology that we've been inspired to use based on science fiction shows. For example, you'll notice we're using octagonal paper, as seen on Battlestar Galactica. And I just want to extol the benefits of this. I can't say exactly how, but my life is so much better in the future.
A little informal, irreverent perhaps, but so far that doesn't sound too different. Then again, he did have a puppet show featuring shadow puppets.
At that point, the bird was joined by a second bird who said,
I couldn't help overhearing your rhetoric over here. You have quite a discourse prepared.
And the first bird said,
Yes, I have spent my whole life sorting it out. Very good,
said the second bird.
Although I disagree completely, I feel violently at odds with your speech. Oh,
said the first bird.
Yes,
said the second.
I have always held to an opposing axiom, which is that students should be taught complexities, which will entice them to understand those complexities by learning the basics.
The first bird was horrified that such logic existed in the fowl kingdom, and a maddening argument unfolded, magnificent in scope, which went on for a solid hour.
By now, the audience was prepared for something quite different. Not every talk on a programming language begins with a shadow play. Then again, most talks don't include animated shorts like this one.
Okay, everyone. Settle down, take a seat. Ruby is getting tons of hits right now. It's all over the press.
We wish we could offer our awestruck applause, but we cannot.
Right now, anything is possible with Ruby. First of all, it's unstoppable. The hype machine is totally rolling down the street. People have been trying to hit the brakes. The brakes on the hype machine are all burned out and they don't work anymore. And second, so many great projects have used Ruby that it's proof that you can do anything you desire. Any of your wildest dreams can come true.
I used Ruby to lure Catherine Zeta-Jones into my unicorn petting zoo.
You have a unicorn petting zoo?
Made entirely of Ruby.
Now, let's think of where Ruby might be in just 3 years. I want you guys to use your imaginations. Walk around inside the planes of your unrealized selves. who you could be, what you could be, anything that could be. Perhaps start with a mental image of magic shooting out of your fingers, and go from there. Ruby in 3 years. Go!
Lecture, shadow play, animated short, very multimedia. But what are we missing? Oh, original music. Wise presentation included original songs as well, performed live in front of the audience. People are still talking about this one.
You can wear a hat without knowing Ruby. And you can wear a simple glove without knowing Ruby. But can you take a big list of all of your friends with all of their names and addresses in the world and parse it right up and compute the distances from one friend to another, the shortest route to travel in a circle, perhaps even computing in all the different plane ticket costs? Well, oh, for that, might I recommend Ruby? You can raise a cockatiel without knowing any Ruby. And you can pet a nice giraffe without knowing Ruby at all. But can you scan for MP3s from off of the blogs, storing them in organized folders on your hard drive, keeping those folders down to CD burning size, so one folder will fit on a CD real nice, and every compilation represents a different website, so later you can listen and find out which website for you is right. Oh, well, for that, might I recommend Ruby? You can wear plenty of red without knowing Ruby. And supposedly you can write Rails code without knowing any Ruby. But tell me this, can you write a book, an entire novel, let's say, and using simple symbols like asterisks around a bolded phrase, and when you're all done, you just run a script, and it'll make all the different formats like HTML and PDF. Well, XHTML 1.0 transitional. And it'll validate the page and email all your friends and post a bunch of "Hey, my book's ready" messages on the web. And, well, I guess we're getting a little bit of feature creep here. You know? I mean, that's just too much. Which I wouldn't recommend. Because you want your next version to be just around the bend. Oh, well, for that, might I recommend...
Why the Lucky Stiff from OSCON 2005. Thanks also to Rail Dornfest and Tim O'Reilly, Bruno Souza, and James Duncan Davidson. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Online meetings made easy. Try it free at GoToMeeting.com/DTF. Email your comments, criticisms, and suggestions to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.